This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to preserve the stories of our World War II veterans so the rest of us don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. And along the way, we sure learn a whole lot about what life was like way back then. We're in for quite a story today from 88-year-old Sherman Kishi of Livingston, California. And in fact, the spot where we're sitting right now isn't too far from where you were born, I guess. You could probably throw an almond hull from here to there, huh?
Just about you can throw it. It's right, very close. I lived there all my life except for those war years.
Although almond hulls don't fly very well. They're not very heavy.
No, but they're very valuable now.
Now, you grew up, like I said, on this property, and your family was farming what?
In the old days, you know, farming started in the community with grapes. So most of the farming in this area was grapes, but over the years it changed because the economy changed and certain commodities didn't do so well. So they had to change along with what happened economically.
Well, and the first thing that came to mind for me in Livingston is in northern Merced County. I think of the yams and the sweet potatoes that Livingston was famous for later. But back in the 30s and 40s, your family was growing grapes?
Yes, we didn't raise sweet potatoes in those days, but sweet potatoes did start very early, mostly started by the Portuguese people that came into the community, and they're the ones that really raised most of the sweet potatoes early on. We took over some sweet potatoes after we had taken out the grapes, and we had gone into some trees as well. But as an interim crop, the sweet potato was a very good crop because it was immediate. In 1 year, you had a crop that paid off. So that was used very much basically as an interim crop when we changed varieties or commodities, whatever you want to call it.
So as you grew up here in the 1930s in a Japanese-American family with a brother and three sisters, were there a lot of other Japanese-Americans around here when you went to school? What was the demographic breakdown like?
You know, this community was started by, I don't know whether you know the story, but it was started by a gentleman who came to the United States way back in the 1880s and established in San Francisco and had a newspaper for many years. And he also had other businesses. But I think that he used to see many of the single men that came to the United States to work, hoping to go back to Japan shortly. But they worked the fields, went up and down the valley, and my father was one of them. And I think he saw them spending their money in the wintertime in San Francisco, gambling and chasing women like young men do. And so he decided that he would start a community somewhere in California and make it available to those people that were the migrant workers. And so his name was Mr. Abiko, and he became very well known amongst the Japanese people. And he actually had a group of people that came together with him, and they looked for a place to purchase and decided on Livingston. And they bought 2,000 acres to begin with. And that became known as the Yamato Colony. And in the legal archives at the present time, it's still called the Yamato Colony. And shortly thereafter, he bought a couple of other pieces. One was the Cressy Colony and the Cortez Colony. And people then immigrated into these areas, and that's how we got started in Livingston.
That is quite a bit different than a lot of other Valley communities where Japanese Americans were during this time period, where they were a small minority. Sounds like, at least in this area, there was a pretty good majority of Japanese Americans.
Well, I don't say it was a majority by any means, but it was still quite a number. I remember the class of 1937, I think, was probably one of the biggest classes that came out of the Livingston High School, and I think they had something like 37 students in the class of probably 75 or 80 students total. So it was a big group. And since then, it's of course come down. And now there's no one with a Japanese name within the school system at all.
Well, there is a Kishi Lane not too far from where we're sitting right now. Tell me what life was like for you as a boy and a teenager here. What kinds of things did you do?
You know, our social life was basically centered around our church. This has always had a church right here that became the center of the community affairs, and most of our social associations was amongst the Japanese people. We grew up with the kids in the school system, in the community, and so we had many Caucasian friends as well, but we hardly ever socialized with them. And that's just the way it was in those days. So that's how we started. But most of our activities were within. We had social events at the church. We also got together frequently and did a lot of swimming in the irrigation canals. Oh, yeah. In fact, all summer, most of us spent most of our time there. So it was a nice life that we had. It was easy, and I guess our folks made enough money to do well for us, so we did well.
I know it was a long time ago, but before everything changed, and it would change in a big way in December of 41. Do you remember having specific dreams or ambitions that you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to do was not be a farmer. But then, you know, I came back from the service. I hadn't gone through college yet. I went into the service right after high school. So I went back to the University of California right after high school, after I got out of the service, and I took an aptitude test. And the darn thing showed that I was most fit to be a farmer. And I was sort of disappointed, but I did work. I got a degree in wildlife conservation. I worked for a short while with the fishing game, but the future looked so dull that I decided I would get out of there. And my brother was running the farm, and asked him if I can come back to the farm and help him. And I came back to the farm and been farming ever since.
Wow. And you're looking good for 88. I've got to tell you, it must be all that tennis and golf. You have any holes in one, by the way?
I have one. And I have a witness that became a judge, so that's on the eighth hole at the Atwater Golf Course.
How many years did you have to wait to get it? How long ago was that?
Let's see. I started golfing when I was 68, and I think I was about 78 when I first got that one and only hole in one that I've ever had in my life.
Well, maybe there's another one coming. Let's go back now. December 7th, 1941. Where were you? Do you remember how you found out about what happened on Oahu?
Yes, very clearly. You know, I was playing tennis in high school, and I was on the high school team, and so we practiced a lot of tennis. And this was early Sunday morning. There were four of us that went to play at the high school tennis courts to try to improve our game. And we were playing at the high school tennis courts, and as we were playing there, a car stopped by the side of the road. There were two or three men in the car, I don't remember, but they opened their windows and started to curse at us and call us all kinds of names, and it just really made us feel bad. And so, of course, we quit very shortly and went home and came home. And when we came home, we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had happened. And that was a change for all the United States and all the world, really, basically. But I think maybe a little bit more for some of us of Japanese ancestry in the United States.
You were born here. Did you have family in Japan that you were in contact with at all?
You know, of course, I was young yet. I was 16 years old when this happened. And my father and mother used to have contact with the family in Japan, but we had never, ever seen them, only heard of them occasionally. And I think my mother went to visit the family way back in 1934. But my father had never gone back to Japan, but he was still in communication with them. So, yes, most of our relatives were in Japan.
When you went to school the next day, what was that like, the day after Pearl Harbor?
You know, the day after Pearl Harbor is a difficult one to remember, but I don't think anything really basically happened at school. The kids were okay. They didn't bother us particularly. Later, as we continued in school, though, there were some incidents that became very onerous to us, and one of them was with one of the teachers that we had at the high school.
What happened?
Well, the family that lived where we live now, this place here, they moved out after 9066 when the Japanese people would still move out of state. And they were going to go live with a daughter that lived in Denver.
So for folks who don't know, Executive Order 9066 was President Roosevelt in February of 42 saying the Japanese people on the West Coast had to be evacuated and sent to different internment camps. So these folks here moved out.
Yes. Of course, the 9066 didn't say that. Actually, it gave the Western Defense Commander the right to do what he thought was right to protect the security of the West Coast. So after the family moved, they sent me a letter, asked for me to pick up their fishing gear because they were going to go fishing in Colorado. And so I came to the house or the garage where the fishing gear was, and I took it home and I sent it off to them. And the person that was running the ranch here for them was one of the teachers, and he just really got onto me at school and was not pleasant at all. And so that was one of the incidents that happened.
So you started to notice people's attitudes toward you and other Japanese Americans change a little bit?
I think it changed a little bit. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their 40s, late 40s, and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden, everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanesey, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time, yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday, so I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942, and that's the day we went into the Assembly Center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the Assembly Center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because, I mean, that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But we didn't think of it that way, I guess.
Have you seen the film American Pastime?
I'm not sure.
It's about baseball in the internment camps during World War II.
Yes, I have seen that. Yeah, there was a gentleman in Fresno who was a very strong advocate of baseball. He was a very good baseball player. He played against Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and some of those guys.
Kenichi Zenimura.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I read his book. Uh-huh. and he became a very dominant in baseball in Poston. Mm-hmm. at one of the camps.
Yeah, it's really incredible the impact that Kenichi Zenimura had in America and overseas. That book, by the way, that Mr. Kishi mentioned is called Kenichi Zenimura, Japanese-American Baseball Pioneer. It's written by Bill Staples Jr. You can find it online. If you haven't seen that film, American Pastime, it is definitely worth your time. And speaking of films, this coming Monday night, October 7th, we're going to be screening the award-winning documentary Honor Flight, One Last Mission. What a powerful hour and a half that is. Huge thanks to the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. It'll be in their state-of-the-art theater auditorium in Old Town Clovis Monday night at 7, a $10 suggested donation. It all benefits Central Valley Honor Flight and the cause of getting our World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C. You may have noticed Honor Flight received a lot of unsolicited media coverage over the last week, thanks to that mystifying decision to barricade a memorial that was built with over $180 million of private donations. This belongs to our World War II veterans. Don't get me started. I'm not going to preach to the choir here, but I'd love to see a Monday night in Clovis. More information at cvhonorflight.org. We'll continue Sherman Kishi's story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.